to the profound thinker, they are not chaotic, haphazard, or uncertain about this universe and the laws which govern it. To gain any objective there is the law of nature. It is the principle and method involved for checking, testing, and weighing the results of our endeavors. So it is too in this science of nature, and similar methods can be traced by any careful student in all religious scriptures, expressed in different words in various languages. We wish to enter the kingdom of God, but how? With the help and guidance of one who has himself entered and can guide us there, is the simple reply from the masters. Is it possible? It is a knowledge which is exact and as sure as 2 and 2 make 4, is their reply again. It is not enough to be content with holy books and the singing of praises and the hymns. We must strive for the same degree of advancement as the authors of the talks and knowledge recorded in these books have achieved. Their experience must become our experience. For what a man has done, a man can do, of course, with proper guidance and help. We should stop at nothing short of this. We have hardly a dim spark of love for him. Will it help to cherish a hope? This is another question asked. And saints reply, it is sufficient to make you eligible for the higher science of approach to him. It is a pleasing ray of hope. Oh, if this small spark would be kindled into a flame. Again we ask, Jesus, another great master, spoke so lovingly of him, but we are sinners and there may not be much hope for us in this age. The master's soothing reply is, no matter, you are the worst of sinners, stop where you are. There's hope for everybody, even in this crucial age. Ages ago, nature provided for us materially and spiritually. Today, the same unchangeable law is operating, and will continue to do so in the future. There's food for the hungry, and water for the thirsty. Nature's demand and supply works. It is only through a living master that one can contact the Almighty God within. In Sanskrit, contemplation of objects or images is not advised, which is indeed harmful to progress. Photographs of the masters are for remembrance and recognition only, and on no account should we become attached to such external practices. A man, according to the science of Paravidya, is not entitled to be called man in the true sense of the word, unless he has full knowledge, both theoretical and practical, of a distinguished position in creation, his several component parts, body, mind, and soul, in this order of comparative importance, and his relationship with the unseen power while yet living on this earth. He who does not understand this much has not been introduced to the first lesson and is yet to begin the alphabet of man. The saints therefore impress the need of man-making. When scientifically observed facts drawn from practice and experiment are explained verbally to a gathering by a master saint, it is called satsang external. This satsang constitutes the theoretical side of their teachings, whereas the actual performance to develop and achieve inner advancement is the practical part called meditation and satsang internal. Conscientious practice brings fruit within days or weeks, and it is not necessary to wait years for results. A true master gives first-hand experience on the very first sitting. We are not all of the same mental standard, and thus the time will differ. When the practical side is neglected due to lack of firmness or determination, carelessness or pressure of the circumstances, scholars of the many religious schools dwell more and more upon theory alone. The decline of the science then commences and man finds no solace. This is usually the case when a master leaves the body. Adequate provision, however, is made for the revival of this science in every age, when both the positive and negative powers commence their rounds again, the former through the agency of master souls, while the latter work through persons, so-called masters, who lack practical experience or are deluded in theoretical disputations. These master souls, though quite ordinary men in appearance, are a great deal more. Just as it is difficult for us to judge a scientist, a doctor, or an engineer until they speak out or display their skill, so too we cannot recognize their aptitude and authority till we have experienced the divine power working through them. In this science, there is no secrecy or mystery. The objective is constructive and beneficial to man. So saints have torn aside the curtain of secrecy to make it available to each and everyone who calls. There is an unseen power working through the saints. Why this power prefers to remain concealed from the human eye is a question to be asked directly by contacting the human pole, the master saint, through whom the power is working. This is the only medium of approach to him. If we wish to use electric energy, we must go to a switch or pole which will put us in contact with the powerhouse. This unseen power can be called a sea of love. When we wish to bathe, we go to the edge where the shallow waters begin and say, we have bathed in the sea. Thus to experience that power and to derive real benefit from the knowledge of God, we have to go to the only source of contact, the master saints. They, the nature has designed man to leave his physical body at will, transcend to higher spiritual planes, and then return to the body. They help each aspirant personally, and each receives a practical experience, how little it may be, during the very first sitting at the time of initiation. A person who is competent to give man this personal experience of withdrawal or separation temporary from the body, and who can thus put him on the way to higher spiritual realms, is a genuine master, saint, or sadhu. The heads of different religious organizations were intended to do just this, but we may judge for ourselves their efficiency today. The first-hand experience we receive through the kindness and grace of a real saint is in itself the solution of the problem of death. According to the Bible, unless you are born anew, you cannot enter into the kingdom of heaven. So to be born again is to leave one's body and enter into the beyond, a transition from the physical to the astral. Someday, we have to leave this temporary structure, which, like a building of bricks and mortar, deteriorates with time. There is no appeal in the laws of nature against the death sentence. We fear death because of the agony, suffering, and uncertainty about the unknown beyond. We fear illness because it brings us near death's door. And so we struggle to live, though we know our end is certain. No soothing words from the doctors, friends, relatives, or priests can bring peace and comfort to our minds. At the time, nature's destructive process commences. This is the natural course of things, and we cannot deceive nature. What then is the remedy? There is only one way out of this abyss of despair, and it is to adopt and accustom ourselves during our lifetime to nature's process, to move side by side with nature, and master the process of withdrawal of spirit current from the body while in the conscious state through the help of a saint, and this without any suffering or trouble whatsoever. This is not a possibility, but a remarkable fact. Our jaya will know no bounds when we come into possession of a secret that has baffled man for so many centuries. We become supermen in possession of a key to peace and heaven, of which we had till then only read about in sacred scriptures. Arise, therefore, and awake, before it is too late to put this sacred science into practice. If we closely observe the process of death in a dying man, we see the pupils of his eyes turn upwards a little, and afterwards they may return to normal, and then he becomes senseless. When they draw upwards too much, he dies. Life ebbs out via the root of the eyes and is disconnected from the sight of the physical body and the organs of sense. Knowledge of this process and the method by which to travel this very way during our lifetime is the solution to the problem of death. No exercises are necessary, no drugs to swallow, and no blind faith to cultivate. This mystery of life and death is solved easily through the help of a master saint who will give you experience of the process and put you on the high road to higher realms. Even when acting indirectly through an authorized agent, he still remains the responsible power. Distance is immaterial to him. What is there gained by this process? This cannot be described on paper. At initiation, the aspirant sees the real light within him grow to the radiance of several suns put together, whereas normally the eyes are covered by a thick veil of darkness. He now realizes that the tradition of the lighted candle found in churches and temples is to remind man of the divine light of heaven within. He understands that the unceasing internal sound he contacts within is the divine link called Word by Christ, Kalma and Raya Asmani by the Quran, Nad by the Vedas, Udgit by the Upanishads, Sarosha by the Zoroastrians, and Naam and Shabd by the saints and masters. He meets the master within, talks to him face to face, and is henceforth certain of his grace, guidance, and protection wherever he may go, even at the other end of the earth. With evident proofs before him, he is now confident of himself and the science. Only now he can be called a theist in the true sense of the word, and can smile at those who talk of religion as a fool's paradise, a phantom conjured up by the craft of priests, the opinion of the masses, and the idiot's dream. He has found a sure ingress through the doorway of heaven. In this life, is on the threshold of viewing both internally and externally the secrets of nature. He is verily knocking at the door of heaven and tapping inside. Words of opposition cannot shake his faith in the science as the master guides him forward. Death becomes a voluntary process. Past, present, and future merges into one, He grasps incontestable truth, with the whole intelligence in the palm of his hand. Liberated from the body, which now appears a husk clothed in rags, he feels his soul, inseparable part of the eternal spirit, and presses onwards to his original source. The world appears a dream to him, but under instructions from his master, he returns to his mundane life, wise and fearless in the discharge of his duties. Just as in any other science, certain preliminary qualifications are there too required before progress can be made. Married life, hard work, or a poor environment is no bar. It does not count in your favor that you may hold a high position or possess immense wealth. Neither does membership of a particular faith serve as a recommendation. Wherever he may be, man must strive for nobility of character, self-control, and purity of heart. Purity in thought, word, and deed is essential. Blessed are the pure at heart, for they shall see God. An ethical life is a stepping stone to spirituality. But spirituality is, however, not just ethical life. This we must always bear in mind. We can divide man's life into one, that, and two, his dealings with others. With regards to that, vegetarianism and teetotalism is essential. Thou shalt not kill. And live and let live should be our principle in life. Body is a temple of God and a sacred place. We are not to neglect it or abuse it. We should take best possible care to maintain it. With regard to our dealings, we should sow the seed of kindness in order to reap its fruit. Love and humility is most necessary. Do to others as you would wish they should do unto you. Love and all blessings shall be added unto you. Love thine enemies. All intoxicants are also to be avoided, as they make us morbid and lose consciousness. These are not empty sayings, but very wise advice. Each thought, each deed, and each word has to be accounted and compensated for in nature. Every cause has an effect, and every action brings about a reaction. Uproot the cause and the effect disappears. This has been done by the masters who have transcended these laws. Others are bound by the bonds of karma. The root cause of physical existence and the clever device of nature to maintain this existence. The law of karma sees to it that we are paid an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth in the shape of joy or suffering. It is a goading whip in the hidden hands of nature. The mind contacts karma, puts a covering on the soul and rules the body through the organs and senses. Although it is the soul that can impart strength to the mind, the latter has taken up sovereignty and governing instead. Even accomplished yogis and mystics who can transcend to higher spiritual realms are not left untouched by the hand of karma. Saints classify karma in three distinct groups as follows. First, sanchit, are stored. Good or bad deeds that stand to our account as earned and contacted in all these bodies of any order of creation, counting from the day of first appearance of life on earth, else man knows nothing about them or their extent. Second, prarabdha, fate or destiny, the result and effect of which has brought man into his present body and has to be weighed in this life. Second, prarabdha, fate or destiny, the result and effect of which has brought man into his present body and has to be weighed in this earth. The reaction of these karma comes to us unexpectedly and unperceived in obligatory form, and we have no control over it whatever. Good or bad, we have to tolerate or bear this karma, laughing or weeping as it happens to suit us. 3. Kiriman, current account of our actions and deeds in the present body. This is distinct from the above two groups, and here man is absolutely free to do exactly as he pleases within certain limits. Knowingly or unknowingly, deeds committed and coming under this heading bear fruit. The result of some of these we reap before we die, and the residue is transferred to the Sanchit storehouse. Karma is the cause of rebirth, and each birth is in turn followed by death. Thus the cycle of enjoyment and suffering, birth and death, continues. As you wish, so you become. It is the simple law of nature owing to which this universe exists. No amount of integrity or genius can absolve a man as long as there is the slightest trace of karma. Ignorance of the law is no excuse. And though there may be some concession or relaxation with man-made laws under special circumstances, there is no allowance made for this in nature's laws. Prayers, confession and atonement may give temporary mental relief, but they cannot overcome karma. All karma must be wiped out completely before permanent salvation can be found. Disturbed by these facts, man seeks solace in deep pious doctrines, or when he comes to know that both good and bad deeds are fetters, one of gold, the other of iron, he turns to renunciation. Different faiths promise relief, but he soon finds out that this is only temporary. How then does a master approach this problem? At the time of initiation, he takes entire charge of karma of his disciples. First, the Sanchit account, or big general account, is squared up. The process is similar to putting a handful of seeds in a pan and placing it on a fire, which then causes the seeds to puff up and lose the property of growing again. Then the Kiriman, new account, is dealt with. After warning his disciples to guard against opening any new account of bad deeds, the master grants his general clemency in respect of such past deeds, part of which the disciple has already settled in this life after the time of initiation. Prarabdha, destiny, karma is not touched by the saints, because this is the cause of the physical body, which would vanish to the interference with nature's laws. A very small amount of karma now remains to be tolerated in the physical body for the remaining years of the disciple's life. But even this is softened by the grace of the master. In moments of misery, worry and trouble, the master is our refuge. He acts unperceived at any distance. Just as the mother of a sick child holds the child securely in her lap during an operation so that it does not feel the pain, so too the master holds us in a loving embrace. Out of the abundance of sympathy, love and kindness, the saints at times take upon their own shoulders some karmic suffering of their disciples through the law of Sinti. There is no court of trial after death for a love-hearted disciple. The master is all in all for him. Why does a master saint take all this on himself? Because he inherits his merciful nature from God above, who commissions him to personally distribute this treasure of mercy. Thus he is honored like God. And Saint Mark has volumes of books written in praise of the masters. And as many more books written will hardly do justice to the vastness of their love and kindness. Time casts its heavy shadow on man. He has to toil hard to keep pace with the changing times. So deeply is he absorbed in his external needs and desires that he forgets all about contentment, sympathy and love. Entangled and surrounded by the deadly five, lust, anger, greed, attachment and vanity, he stumbles and cries out to the unseen for help. Heaven's mercy is stirred, and so as times stiffen, the Almighty extends his help to masters more and more lavishly. Such is the case in this Kali Yuga, the Iron Age. It is indeed very hard to believe that anyone can be above the five passions mentioned above, and that he can enter the kingdom of heaven during his lifetime. All mankind is under the control of these five. Only master can save a man from their clutches. We all demand reliable proof before committing ourselves, and this is given by a master in the shape of an experience of the life impulse, or norm, world, and inner vision. Contact with the master is essential. Those who keep aloof and depend on themselves or rely on tradition and priests, equally ignorant as themselves, are deprived of contact with this power. And as the saying goes, when the blind leads the blind, both will fall into the ditch. Indifference, non-acceptance, and disbelief will not be to our advantage when nature enforces its universal ordinance. Our position will be that of a pigeon who, on seeing a cat approaching, shuts its eyes and believes that now the cat cannot molest it. But in a few seconds, the poor bird is in the powerful jaws of the cat. It is too late to think of escape now. Be alert while there is yet time. Perhaps it will not be out of place to explain here the term spirituality, which is often confused with blind faith in sacred books. A display of miracles, psychic phenomena, or yogic powers. Spirituality is inner experience, and its alphabet begins where all philosophy and yoga practices terminate. It is a soul. When one says, I am body, it is a feeling based on intellect and is defined as ignorance. When he says, I am not body, I am awakened soul, it is learnt knowledge or theory only. But when he gets actual experience of the soul by self-analysis and contacts the over-self, it is spirituality. The first practical lesson commences when there is complete withdrawal from the physical body through the kindness of a practical master. No one can withdraw and separate himself unaided from the physical body. If, however, anyone claims otherwise and thinks he can, he deceives himself. All attempts without the assistance of a master who alone is qualified to impart this experience will end in utter failure. masters come to distribute this treasure of spiritual blessings to the seekers after truth. Spirituality cannot be bought. It is not taught. It is caught by contact with spiritual people. Moreover, nature's gifts with air, water, light, etc., free. Spirituality is also nature's gift and given gratis by masters. Likewise, spirituality cannot be acquired from books, which is a fact all sacred scriptures uphold. Books are the valuable record of inner experiences in spirituality. They fill up gaps in history and contain messages of past masters which help us to verify the facts revealed by present masters, thus confirming our faith in the science. Man is confused by the various translations, interpretations and expositions, each different from the other, which instead of relieving his mind tend rather to bewilder and confuse him. His egoism too has created hundreds of religious circles whose aim is aloofness and narrow orthodoxy instead of love, disintegration instead of concentration. Torn between conflicting emotions, is it then a wonder men think of hating more? For an understanding of the science of the masters, we attend satsang, where the majority of our doubts are clear. Direct inquiries from the masters will take care of the remaining doubts. All questions receive the same calm concentration and no arguments are offered. Rich or poor, high or low, all receive equal attention in the same manner as a doctor should attend to the sick. A true master views a man's rights and wrongs as clearly as one sees the pickled contents in a glass jar, but he reveals nothing. Sitting before him, even those who do not understand his language are benefited in the same way as one in a perfumer's shop enjoys the smell of sweet scents. The master showers blessings through his looks, which eager ones catch. His eyes are a wonderful spray of love. Do not judge such a master by his external appearance, genealogical descent, rich or poor attire, country of origin, how he talks, walks, eats, or the position he holds, the number of books he is author of, or by what people say of him. First receive the inner experience he promises, and then judge from that elevated angle of vision. Self-experience is the criterion for judging a genuine master. Any living person who sees things from a height.
Well, good morning, everybody. Welcome to the Satsang from Master Kirpal Singh. Today is the birth anniversary of Master Sawan Singh, 150 years today. At the end of the satsang, I'll play a 10-minute recording of Master on this birthday. This morning, our reader is Joanna Swanson. Are you there, Joanna?
All set to go, John.
Go ahead.
Well, good morning to all my very dear brothers and sisters on this auspicious occasion. And as you know, I have been reading from our great Master Kirpal Singh's book, The Mystery of Death. We left off last time in the middle of Chapter 3. I will pick up there, and if there is time, I will go on to Chapter 4. With the process of withdrawal of the sensory currents from the body, the death-like process commences. You have not to do anything except simply to sit in a calm, composed, and fully relaxed position with the attention fixed at the eye focus and engage in Simran, or repetition of the charge names which carry the life impulse of the masters through the ages and serve as passwords into the regions beyond. While so established in an easy posture or asana in healthy surroundings, you forget yourself, entirely forgetting even the life-giving and life-sustaining pranas or vital airs, which will of themselves gradually slow down and grow rhythmic, as do the entire respiratory and circulation systems of the body. At first, the sensory currents begin gradually to withdraw from the extremities of the body, from the tips of the hands and feet, and come upwards, gradually passing through the various bodily centers or chakras, each of which being the region of one of the five elements of which the body is composed, until leaving the heart center, they reach the throat center, the seat of Shakti, the mother of the universe, the all-pervading energy, benumbing the entire bodily system below the eyes. From there, they proceed directly to the center behind the eyes, the Ajna chakra. This is where the spirit currents get collected and gain an entry into the foxhole within, Brahmrinda, or the hole of Brahm, and have a peep into the Brahman or cosmic universe. This is the 10th aperture in the body, the only inlet apart from the 9 outlets. This is the place where you have to knock and get admittance into the realms above, realms more vast, more glorious, self-luminous and self-resounding with rapturous strains of celestial music, music unheard anywhere in the physical world which has been left below, now no more than a great slum area, fraught with miseries and tribulations, fading into a faint reflection of the world of ideas, as Plato puts it. At this stage, man becomes truly blessed by having access to the ethereal region, the world of spirit. He is now at the threshold of the astral world in the company of the radiant form of the master, the Guru Dev, with his Gurbhakti complete in every respect. When a disciple reaches the radiant form of the master, his job of self-effort is over. The Guru Dev now takes charge of the spirit of the man and trains the spirit in Shabd Bhakti, or devotion to the sound current, which is his own real form, the Shabd Swarup. From here, he takes the disciple along with him on the spiritual journey that lies through countless regions of varying spiritual sublimity, into the causal or instrumental plane, the seed world, the ever-pregnant mother with vast and countless regions lying enfolded in its womb, and then on into the super-cosmic beyond, the Parbrahm, where there are planes of silence, sun, and great silence, mahasun, and finally on to Satchkhand, where dwells the formless one of ineffable radiance, the ocean of consciousness, called Satpurush, the primal manifestation of the Supreme Being. This holy process of withdrawal is simple, natural, and does not involve any onerous austerities. It does not involve a drastic control of the pranas. The masters have evolved this rare technique and termed it science of the soul. It can best be learned under the able and competent guidance of some master saint, well versed in the theory and practice of the life current, the word, that exists in all created things, the creative and sustaining principle upholding all. All of the scriptures of the world bear testimony to this fundamental truth. from the Vedas. In the beginning was Prajapati, the Supreme Being. With him was Vak, the Holy Word. And the Vak, the Word, was verily the Supreme Brahm, or Brahm. And from St. John, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The same was in the beginning with God. All things were made by him, and without him was not anything made that was made. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. And from the Quran, Kalam or Kalma is the all-creative principle. God spake, Kun fiat kun, let there be. And from this fiat, the whole creation sprang into being. And from Nanak, Shabda is the creator of the earth. Shabda is the creator of the firmament. Shabda is the source of light. And Shabda resides in the heart of all. It is on this basic principle of all existence, light and sound of God, that the Master gives a practical experience to all those who come to him in search of truth, the rare boon of holy initiation, an explanation of the theory, and a first-hand experience of the saving lifelines within, is not an end in itself, but just a beginning. A preliminary step for starting on the long journey of the soul to the true home of the Father. Those who have chosen to undertake this course of life are indeed fortunate. They experience this rare phenomenon of death in life and thus become Jivan Mukat, or liberated beings while yet in flesh, leading a life in fullness on whatever plane they like, but always remaining within the will of God. Such a lucky one, fully entrenched in Godhead, is in full control of his intellect, mind, and senses. He is the master of the house and not a handmaid of his mind and intellect. Like a good charioteer sitting in the chariot of the body, he directs his intellect aright, which in turn gives a correct lead to his mind. And his mind, when trained in the path of righteousness, refuses to be swayed by the senses, which gradually lose their potency and cease themselves to be attracted by the glamour of sense objects. Thus is reversed the primal process of expansion, and one gets settled in himself, with the result that the still waters of the mind begin to reflect the light of God, fulfilling the ancient maxim, unless the senses are subdued, the mind is stilled, and the intellect too is in a state of equipoise, one cannot witness the glory of God. The rich experience of life in fullness is variously called the second birth, the birth of the spirit as distinct from the birth of the flesh. Led by the spirit, one now lives and walks in the spirit, abandoning the lust of the flesh and cuts right across the inexorable law of cause and effect or karma, which keeps all others in perpetual bondage. With the day-to-day progress on this path, new vistas of indescribable joy and beatitude open up, and new horizons loom into view, encompassing the totality of all that is, thus giving greater and greater awareness, first personal, then supramental, next cosmic, and then supercosmic. Hereafter, the liberated souls, freed from all the shackles of mind and matter, enjoy perpetual bliss in the life of the spirit, with an outlook on life entirely changed. The vast creation now becoming the manifestation of the one life principle, pulsating everywhere in him and around him and in all things, animate and inanimate. The world that he now witnesses is totally different from the world known to him before. It now looks to be the veritable abode of God, and one sees God truly dwelling in it, nay, in every constituent part of it. For all created things appear like so many bubbles in one vast ocean of life. Hereafter, the liberated soul lives unto the Lord and dies unto the Lord. Like St. Paul, he gets crucified in Christ, and Christ lives in him. And with repetitive experience of the death process, he triumphantly swallows death in victory, the Father and the Son becoming one. Though the outward man of flesh and bone still persists and continues to exist, to spin out what remains of the karmic web of life, yet the inward man, the spirit in man, is renewed, growing stronger and more sublime with time. From Thomas A. Kempis, forsake the flesh for the spirit. Learn to die so that you may begin to live. And in this context, we have from Kabir, while the people are mortally afraid of death, I welcome death as the harbinger of bliss. Die and be thou dead to the world. Such a death I experience many times a day. In all the four Bible Gospels, we come across so many references of like nature. From St. Matthew, St. Mark, and St. Luke, he that findeth his life shall lose it, and he that loseth his life for my sake shall find it. And from St. John, he that loveth his life shall lose it, and he that hateth his life in this world shall keep it unto life eternal. Dadu, a celebrated saint, says, O Dadu, learn to die ere death overtakes thee. What will it profit thee when die thou must? Guru Nanak also says the same thing. O Nanak, practice such a yoga discipline as may teach thee to die in life. Prophet Muhammad, too, exhorted his ummah, or the faithful, to practice the art of dying before death. Before thy death, do thou die. The mystic Muslim divines like Hafiz, Shams Tabriz, and Maulana Rumi greatly emphasized the importance of such a unique inner experience and said, so long as you do not transcend the plane of the senses, you remain unaware of the inner life. Thou hast raiments besides the outer physical one. Why then dost thou fear to come out of the body? One may go on multiplying any number of apothegms on this subject. So we may close it with a passage from the writings of Earl R. Wasserman. Many are only imperfect individualizations of the one, and death permits the unindividualized and hence unbounded spiritual life. The post-mortal life, therefore, is a spiritual existence, for death, destroying the many-colored dome, allows the soul to outsoar the shadows of night instead of working inwards to destroy organic existence. What then appears to be physical destruction proves to be spiritual immortality. What we call life is a decay. Therefore, earthly confinement, the mortal atmosphere, stains the radiance of eternity. On the other hand, the resurrected soul, reincorporated into the one, not the shadow of death or physical matter, is discovered in the true sense, spreading itself throughout nature, for the final reality everywhere is spirit. Were the atmosphere of mortality removed, man would perceive that the one remains and that heaven's light forever shines. And that day and night are one and even, so life and death, Lucifer and Vesper, and that the ultimate reality of both earthly life and post-mortal eternity is the spiritual one. And this realization of the spiritual identity of mortal and post-mortal life finally ceases the pairings of opposites like life and death, since the one glows through time and change unquenchably the same. Then Wasserman continues and goes on to say, learn to go unterrified into the gulf of death, for where mortal existence ends, the spiritual existence begins. With death, the resurrected soul outsoars the shadows of the night and is reincorporated into the changeless one. Prophet Muhammad also speaks of death in life in much of the same strain, saying, a death like this will not take thee to the grave, but it shall lead thee from darkness to light. Learn then to die every day by transcending the body. When a man learns to transcend the human in him, the master in his radiant form comes in to help the soul onwards to its true home, guiding the soul on the higher planes, both in one's lifetime and even after, when the mortal coil is finally cast off. In this connection, Nanak says, O Nanak, snap all the ephemeral ties of the world and find thou a real friend in some saint. The former shall leave thee while ye live, but the latter shall stand by thee even in the hereafter. Following the instructions of a Satguru, take hold of truth. Be thou true to him, and he shall stand true to thee unto the last. A Muslim dervish likewise says, O brave soul, take a firm hold of his hem, for he is truly above all the worlds here and above. Similarly, we find in the Gospels from St. Matthew and St. Paul's letter to the Hebrews, lo, I, Christ's power, shall be with thee till the end of the world. I shall not leave thee nor forsake thee. In this way, the highest mission of human life is achieved, and the fullness of life is experienced. This is the subject of contacting the self by the self, which disengages from the thorns and thistles of the worldly life under the proper guidance and help of a master soul who vouchsafes this inner experience to all alike, irrespective of sex, age, avocation, religious affinities and affiliation, and social orders based on blood, social caste, color, or creed. The spirit has got to be divested of the false halo of the self-created and self-projected personality that one unwittingly weaves around himself. Unless one becomes a pure spirit, divested of the love of all created things, one cannot enjoy the life of the Creator, which is a life of fullness in beatitude. That ends chapter 3, and we will now begin chapter 4, called Death in Bondage. In nature, death follows life, and life proceeds from death. Death, as a cessation of life in any form, is but a prelude to reliving in another form, and generally at a higher level of existence than before, and in better and more congenial environments. Evolution is the law of life, and it consists in the active flowering of the latent possibilities in the spirit matter. It comprises in its compass not only evolution of the spirit matter, which grows more plastic and translucent in its onward march, but also evolution of the forms from minerals to human entities. And lastly, expansion of self-consciousness. The so-called dead matter is not really dead, though the spiritual energy in it may for some time be in a congealed state. A worn-out garment whose utility has been outgrown is to be cast off and replaced by a new one, molded in the fashion one desires the most, such as the law of Dame Nature, the handiwork of God. The kindly Father, it is said, hath ordained that his children may have what they ardently wish for. In providing the essentials of life on the earth plane, love, light, and life, and the necessary adjuncts thereto, like earth, water, sun, air, and space, together with all the means of sustenance, the Supreme Lord of the universe is munificent beyond measure and provides the same freely to all, though each one gets according to his need and measure of descent. The Lord's bounties are innumerable and inexhaustible, and for ages man has fed upon them in diverse ways. Not satisfied with the limitless gifts, man ever craves for more, more of silver and gold, more of the amenities and conveniences of life, and more of everything else, and he struggles and strives endlessly for them. Instead of being grateful to the Lord for all that he has, by his grace, provided for us, we curse ourselves, curse those around us who are in better and more affluent circumstances than we, curse the innocent stars above, and do not hesitate to cavil at and criticize in stinging terms our own fate or destiny, which we have by our own actions forged for ourselves. With all his possessions, one loses his head for just a pittance. Human life is a great privilege, a rare asset, and a blessing. It comes after passing through a long evolutionary process, extending over time unending. It is an opportunity for amassing the riches of spirituality that lie hidden within us and of which we are hardly aware. But the majority of us are after ephemeral non-essentials, the sense pleasures of the earth life, and not real happiness. For these short-lived and fleeting sense pleasures, which we may or may not get, we by all means, fair or foul, try to move heaven and earth, and more often than not pay dearly, even with our own life, and quit the stage of human life with many a deep regret for one thing or the other, and for the unworthy means employed and the sorrows suffered in the attempt. Nature is not extravagant in her design and purpose. As one thinks, so he becomes. Our feelings and emotions, thoughts and passions, desires and aspirations do not die with the death of the body. They constitute an inner vest, an undergarment, the astral body, beneath the physical cloak, and the spirit clothed therein goes out to be covered by yet another mantle, drawing upon the karmic seeds lying in store in the causal or seed body, the precious treasure chest. It is this causal or instrumental body with its vast resources that helps its inmate, the spirit, in fashioning a new mold, a fresh tabernacle of flesh, which may serve as a fitting vehicle for the fulfillment of what lies uppermost in the unconscious self. The curtain finally rises, unfolding the entire panorama of life down to the minutest detail ere one passes out of sight from the stage of life. On the deathbed, one may get a glimpse of reality, but then it is too late to comprehend it. This process works on, giving at the end of each span on Earth fresh momentum to the wheel of life and death with its natural concomitants of joys and sorrows, weal and woe, sometimes up, sometimes low, moving in interminable gyres as one is never satiated with all that one gets in one's sojourn on Earth, and each goes on adding new hopes and new desires mixed with many a regret for what he wanted and did not receive. He is thus unwittingly engaged perpetually in sowing the dragon's teeth, and life after life he spends in fighting his self-started battles with his own self-raised armed bands, which like shadows follow on his heels as untamed furies or avenging spirits. Nature, like the potter's wheel, provides the means of earth life in the form of many clay pots, one after the other, for slaking the insatiable thirst and expectations of each individual. Weighed down by countless desires from top to toe, one makes a slave of himself. Without them, one would revel in his godhood. What is man after all? God plus desire. And conversely, what is God? Man minus desire. The great philosopher-poet William Wordsworth draws a beautiful pen picture of a growing child in his memorable Ode on Intimations of Immortality from Recollections of Early Childhood. He says, "The soul that rises with us, our life's star, hath had elsewhere its setting, and cometh from afar. Not in entire forgetfulness, and not in utter nakedness, but trailing clouds of glory, do we come from God, who is our home. Heaven lies about us in our infancy. Shades of the prison house begin to close upon the growing boy, but he beholds the light, and whence it flows, he sees it in his joy. The youth who daily farther from the east must travel still is nature's priest, and by the vision splendid is on his way attended. At length the man perceives it die away and fade into the light of common day. Earth fills her lap with pleasures of her own, yearning she hath in her own natural kind, and even with something of a mother's mind, and no unworthy aim, the homely nurse doth all she can to make her foster child, her inmate man, forget the glories he hath known, and that imperial palace whence he came." This, then, is the sordid picture of life on earth, as we ourselves witness from day to day. Even having our fill as preordained, we are yet hungry, ravenously hungry, for more and more pelf and power, more of ephemeral pleasures and sense enjoyments. Far from being thankful what we have of the bounties of nature, we look before and after and pine for what is not. Nature cannot remain a silent spectator of our unappeased gluttony, and with her magic wand turns us Circe-like into swine, so that we may have our fill of the piffle and be done away with. It is only some wise Ulysses, armed with the magic flower from Mercury, the messenger of the gods, who can fight the enchantress on her own ground and rescue his followers, getting them reconverted from swine into men, and along with them all others held in captivity by the sorceress in many different forms, each according to his or her innate nature. It is the type of the ruling passions that determines our course of life, not only here right now in the living present, but also in the hereafter. This will end our reading for today, and in closing, may we simply say, Thank you, Blessed Master, for allowing us to be together to hear your holy word. And we thank thee for taking us as your children. Amen.
Joanna, for the wonderful reading. As mentioned at the beginning, after I do a count, I'm going to play a 10-minute talk by Master on the occasion of the birthday of Master Sawan Singh, which today is the 150th anniversary. So just excuse me a minute. So today we had 74 people at the satsang. Now, hang on a minute, I'll move on to this talk.
Would you write the life history of your master? Dear gentlemen and ladies, today is the birth anniversary of one of the greatest saints who ever visited the earth, at whose feet I had the good luck to sit and enjoy. The birth anniversary of a great man means for us to tread the path of the truth as explained by him, to follow the teachings in their right perspective and digest them in our own lives. Once a man asked the follower of a great man, would you write the life history of your master? He said, yes, he will do. After some time, they asked him whether he had written the life of his master. And he replied that he was writing very fast, very hard. And he's writing in his practical life, and is still to be written. So my words mean to say that to celebrate the birth anniversary of a great saint truly lies in the fact that we tread in the footsteps of the great master. The teachings he gave in a few words were that all mankind was one, whether they were theists or atheists. I have no time as yet to give you a long talk over his life, but just in a nutshell to tell you that he loved the theists as well as the atheists. For he said that soul is within all, and soul is the essence of the Almighty, a drop of the ocean of life. If the poor atheists do not know that they have got anything overhead, it is not their fault, it is their bad luck. So at least we do know that there is God over it, the source of all creation and all souls. So he said that mankind is one. Love all, and all things shall be added unto you. This is the outward way. The biggest religion of mankind is to consider that we all are reading in one class to reach the ultimate goal. This is the highest social religion he preached. In his attendance. There were sometimes thousands of people to attend, of all creeds and colors and denominations. So much so, once I had an experience just to find out how much salt was spent in his kitchen to serve those attending the satsang held by him. And in one day, the salt spent ran up to 10 mounds just consider how grand gathering was there. So whenever they light the flies, bees will hum over it. He was the source of gentleness. He was the source of all spirituality. He was the source of all ethical life. He was competent to raise man's soul from the bondage of mind and matter and give them first an experience into the beyond. He raised man from the abyss of the indriyas, mind and matter, brought them up to contact the divine link within and ultimately reach God. In few words, he was the mouthpiece of God. He always said, it is he who speaks in him. At times, they would give out only this truth when they are left to their own selves. So if you hear, we do not know about the saints, what they are. It's only by hearing to their personal talks, which they give at times, they refer to their origin, their cause of coming into the world, and their mission, which they carried into the world for the uplift of mankind. They come for all the humanity at large. To him, there was no difference. East and West both were dear to him. And those who sat at his feet, they spoke very highly about him. The people came from the West, Dr. Johnson, Alexander, and many others. They also sat at his feet and drank deep into the nectar of divine name and rose into the higher realms. Thanks for the great blessing of the Lord that he sends such like personality into the world to guide the child humanity unto him. And of the so many saints who came in the past, we had the player only sitting at his feet. He was a grand personality. However, how can we define him, give his praises? When I was reading in the school, I put a question to a missionary and asked him why all other saints who are addressed by their followers, they always attach so many epithets to their name. Why Christ does not carry any epithet with it? And the missionary rightly replied that, are you giving any epithets to God? I said, no. Then he said, the sons of God, how can you define them? It is only by praising that we bring them below to the dignity of a man, but they are not men. They are something higher power working at the pole of men. And they are nobody else, no other than the God power overhead. Naturally, we have not seen God who precedes God, because in him he is effulgent, expressible. When we sit at his feet, we simply say, you sat at the feet of the Lord who was residing in him. If you go into the shallow waters and have a bath, you say that you had a bath in the ocean. Similarly, when you sit at the feet of such a great master, you say that at the feet of the Lord over it. We had the good fortune to have seen him with these physical eyes, moving on earth in all humility of saints and humility personified, showering his blessings all round to all who came to his feet, even exception to the blessings he showered on all. Thank you so much for all. And the other gentlemen who are here, who know me by name at least, are by photos which have been sent to them.
Thank you. Now please hang up your phone.